the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone, and happy holidays to all of you. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and since we're talking about the holidays, you know it's the end of the year and time for year-end tax planning, so our guest today is going to be Kim Fischera, and you'll never guess what he's discussing. Yeah, I know. It's year-end tax planning, so that's something you're not going to want to miss here on the program. You know, today in this segment here, Jim and I would like to touch upon an issue that truly hits home when it comes to retirement. It's called managing your income. And it's an issue that has never been harder given the age that we live in, but it's very important. You know, this week, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates a quarter of a point for the first time in a decade. That's incredible. Now, on the surface, that may sound like good news if you're a saver, but I would say don't expect too much because it's really not going to do much for you in the savings area. That has much more to do with other considerations. You know, banks are very quick to raise rates when the Fed hikes rates, but very slow to raise interest rates on deposits. So for those of you who are getting ready to retire or are retired already, I really don't need to tell you how low interest rates actually are. It doesn't matter where you look. From money market funds to bonds to bond funds here or overseas. But there is good news. There are numerous ways to earn 5% if you know where to look. So when couples or individuals are looking at managing cash flow, it has never been this difficult, but you can do it.
You know, that's the interesting thing that for a number of years, for those of us in the financial business, we watched what went on in Japan. You heard about the lost decades, John, and then all of a sudden, here we are. I mean, think about it. The Fed raised interest rates for the first time since 2004. So it's been almost a decade before it ever embarked on a rate raising cycle. For 7 years, we've been stuck at close to zero. And it was something that we always used to look at Japan. Japan's interest rates were incredibly low, and that gave rise to the carry trade because a lot of that money was seeking higher returns elsewhere. If you were getting a quarter of a point at a bank in Japan, well, a lot of that money came overseas and much to our benefit. And that was a whole kind of different trade that was developed in the financial business because of these low interest rates. And here we are in the U.S., and even though the Fed has embarked on a rate-raising cycle, I hate to tell you folks, it's not really going to mean much to you in the form of income. And interest rates are certainly not what they used to be. And even though the Fed has started to raise, as I mentioned, it's going to be years away before we ever get to the point of resembling anything that, John, I guess you and I would call normal.
Well, I've never been normal, so I have a hard time recognizing it.
That's true. As long as I've known you, you've never been normal either. They only knew what went on behind the scenes.
That's true. But that's true of any radio or TV show or movie or whatever. But I think the normalcy you're talking about is the normalcy we experienced, say, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, about the time my father retired, when there were predictabilities, when treasury bills were getting good returns, all of these things. And those days are gone and they're not coming back anytime in the near future.
No. In fact, if you take a look at what you can get in fixed income, John, I mean, we're looking at fixed income yields that used to be what we would find in a money market fund. In fact, it's just the opposite. If you take a look at rates, let's say on the long end, I'm talking about like 20-year, 30-year treasury bonds or corporate bonds, they've actually been flattening. And that can be worrisome because an inverted yield curve where your short-term rates are higher than long-term rates is usually indicative of what you see ahead of a recession. So rates have been stuck in this narrow trading range, and we've been there for about 12 months, between 2-2.3%. Sometimes there was a brief period during the summer where we got up to almost 2.5%, but they're actually lower today than where they were mid-summer when rates spiked to that 2.5%. They were only there for about a week, but nonetheless, people were thinking, well, if we break through 2.5%, maybe we're on our way to 3%. As we were in 2013. The only area that we've seen rates climb is in the area of corporate bonds and emerging markets. And a lot of that is in the high yield space, or what we normally refer to as junk bonds. But even though rates have risen, it has been prices for bonds that have fallen. In other words, if rates are starting to rise or the markets perceive there's some kind of credit risk, then what will happen is they'll drive down the price of the bond, which inversely drives up the yield. So, for example, the ETF high yield, HYG, now yields close to 6%. But it has been within, if you take a look at what you're getting in interest, all that interest, the fund itself has a negative return for the year of 5.4%. And that's one of the things that's been very difficult in 2015 to make money anywhere. About the only place I guess you didn't lose anything was, well, if you stayed in cash.
So there's an example of a high yield, but there's also risk included in that companies can default on their bonds or rates can rise and there can be a loss of principal. So if we know that, what are the options available for investors who need higher yields to live on and pay their bills, much as that normalcy was 40 years ago that we were talking about? Because it really doesn't look promising when you look at traditional safe investments such as CDs, T-bills, or even conservative bond funds. I mean, if we look at bank rates, let's see here, T-bills this morning, 3-month T-bills at a whopping 0.25%. And 2-year treasury notes are at 1%. Woohoo. Bank CDs look a bit better, but not by much. 5-year CDs are running about 1.75%. So what do investors do today to get halfway decent returns? I mean, Wall Street loves low interest rates, but let's face it, Main Street sure doesn't.
You know, it really takes a lot more planning, a lot more thinking outside the box. It's going to take a lot more homework to find them because there are a lot of pockets in the market. You got to look at areas that are unpopular, look at areas that have been beaten down. But when you retire, John, when we're talking about planning for cash flow, you really need to think of your income and expenses in terms of buckets. So we always talk about on this program, basic expenses, which is your main bucket. And then you have to think about future inflation. You have to think about things that you have an interest in, and maybe travel, hobbies, as separate buckets. Then from there, that's how you plan your portfolio and your cash flow. This is a whole new world that we're living in that we call the new normal. People are working longer, staying in the workforce for a longer period of time because they simply don't have the funds or the assets to retire. Or, for example, they may be supplementing their income with part-time work. This is one reason we see so many people now are having to resort to different strategies. And the reason is the rate of returns on assets are so low. In fact, if you look at this year, I can't think of one area of the market that has made money. You lost money in stocks, bonds, and commodities. So this is one reason that I think you see a lot of people get themselves in trouble is they don't think of their retirement years, not only in different phases of retirement, but also thinking of different aspects of their budget. And what you need to do, and we talk about this so often on the program, is to isolate your expenses and then coordinate that with what you're doing with the portfolio. But that isn't what happens. Generally, there's this, what I call this cookie cutter approach to planning, where you basically put together a portfolio. Let's say a person's 65. Okay, you're age 65. 65% goes into bonds, 35% into stocks. Even though I've done a number of shows showing that the equity glide path, the percentage of assets in stock should be lower at the beginning phase of your retirement and increase over time as you age. But John, it just isn't done. And what used to work, when we think about it, before, between stocks and bonds, you know, there were a set of rules and you could pretty much, as you mentioned, plan with some degree of certainty and predictability. Those days are gone and they ended after the financial crisis. But in a market that has been starved for yield, you have to hunt for yield in different places. And not only that, you have to be patient and wait for opportunities when they present themselves. Because as the Fed begins to raise interest rates, as it just did this week, you've seen a lot more volatility come into the market. We saw it begin in 2013 when they announced the beginning of taper. We saw that year the yield on bonds double in size. It was a good year for stocks. It was a terrible year for bonds. But we are seeing a little bit more volatility. Now, that gives you some opportunities. So instead of panicking when you get a market correction, as we did in, let's say, August or September, October, what you do is you have your shopping list. So if a stock goes down 15, 20%, well, guess what? If you're looking for a stock that pays a dividend, you're going to be able to buy that stock at a cheaper price and get a higher dividend yield. So, you know, you're going to have these opportunities that are, let's say, present themselves, but you better have a plan so you know what you're going to do. That, okay, I need to have so much in dividend paying stocks because I need an inflation hedge. I need something in my portfolio that's going to go up over time and is going to provide for increasing medical expenses or increasing cost of living, because you may be in a situation where you're on fixed income, whether it's a pension or you take a look at Social Security in 2016, there will be zero increases to Social Security payments, even though you're going to see some increase in the form of Medicare payments as a result of increasing expenses.
Okay, so let us say that you have a client who needs more income than what the general market provides. What are your moves and what do you have to do that?
There's a number of avenues that you can look at. One would be in an immediate annuity. Depending on your age, I can get yields between 5 and 7%. Now, understand with an immediate annuity, that yield consists of not only interest income, but also is part of your principal, which is being paid back over your lifetime. There are special ETFs out there that are dividend payers where the yields have been as high as 5 to 7%, especially blue chip ETFs that write options or what I call covered calls. Then you have to get stock specific where you can get yields between 4 and 6%. And in most cases, those yields rise each year with dividend increases, but you have to hunt for those yields. Fed starts raising interest rates. For example, the Dow Jones Utility Index, it yields about 3.75%, but the index, including those dividends, is down 7% for the year. REITs generally pay close to 4%, but they've lost ground on principal side as well. So you have to be careful where you look for yield, because it's just like bond funds. You may be looking at bond funds where one fund pays a higher interest rate than another, but you may not realize that you're taking more risk with the higher yielding bond fund because of they may be invested in illiquid junk bonds.
Okay, so if traditional investments, and let's posit here, utilities and rents aren't doing well with the Fed raising interest rates, then where do you look today for yields that are somewhere in the 5% range?
You know, the energy space is one area, but you better do your homework when it comes to looking at yields in the energy sector, because right now it's hemorrhaging. Obviously, the result of lower oil prices. On the day we're doing this show, West Texas Intermediate crude got down to $34. You've got some saying it's going down to 20. I don't buy that. It may get down to low 30s, but when you're looking in the energy space, you want to make sure you're looking at companies that have strong balance sheets, and more importantly, you better look at the company's free cash flow, because that's where the dividend is paid from. And you also want to take a look at what their production is, their CapEx, before you invest, so you could get walloped. A good example was last week, a pipeline company by the name of Kinder Morgan slashed its dividend by 75% last week. And analysts think that more dividend cuts in the energy sector in the future. So if you do your homework, you'll be well worth your while, because you can find yields out there that are protected by cash flow, by a balance sheet. And also, you know, another area that we like, John, are mispriced corporate bonds, where you can get yields in the 5 to 6% range, especially if you can find bonds due for an upgrade in their credit rating, which is kind of where we're looking at right now, because the yields we've been able to get between 5 and 6% in that space. And the great thing about it is the credit ratings of the companies are getting rated upward, which means that makes the bond even safer in terms of credit quality.
Okay, so what I hear you saying here is that there are places you can get 5%, but you do have to do more work to find them. And in this category, Jim, I know you often talk about different buckets for the portfolio, different buckets for the budget, and then different phases of retirement. It seems like they're all related, though.
You know, John, they really are, because if you want to navigate your retirement successfully, you need a plan that does all of these things. You have a bucket that is secured by dependable sources of income, such as, you know, things like Social Security, a pension, or an annuity. And you also want a growth component. I mean, the average couple between the two of you will spend close to 25 years in retirement. And you can bet whatever you're spending money on today, let's say you just retired this year, you can bet those numbers or whatever those expenses are, they're going to be much, much higher 10, 15, 20 years from now, especially in the latter years when you're faced with more medical expenses. And that's why you want some kind of inflation hedge that's going to take care of those rising medical expenses due to old age. And we'll talk about the significance of that with the case study that we'll be talking about here shortly. But how are you going to pay for those expenses when they arrive? And that's something that a lot of people, you know, they retired, they're looking at their present expenses, they're looking at their present income, they think they're fine. Well, they may be fine for the first 5 years. They may not be so fine 10 years, 15 or 20 years out in their retirement. I mean, I had a client whose mother had a stroke early on in the year, and as a result of that, she had to go into assisted living. And she simply did not have the money between her Social Security, her investment income, to pay for that. So the kids are now paying for that expense, which is running over $4,000 a month. So there were expenses that weren't planned for early on in that couple's retirement. And so these are the kind of things that crop up later on, and you want to make sure they don't catch you by surprise and you've been prepared for them.
You know, a primary example came out of my own family because my father passed away in the early part of the 1980s, and he was an accountant. That was his career for all of his life. And he had put mom, prior to his passing, he had put her in treasury bills and I think probably some CDs and things that were A, secure, and B, got a very decent return, which they did, let's face it, right? But that all changed, of course, and it took mom a while to come to grips with that. You know, people tend to keep doing the same old thing, not realizing that there's some kind of a change called for. So what tools do you use today then to meet those needs? I mean, what are you doing with your clients? It's obvious you aren't dealing with the same kind of markets that we did even just 10 to 15 years ago.
I mean, our clients tend to be more on the affluent side, but that term is all relative today. I mean, let's face it, $1 million doesn't buy you the same kind of lifestyle as it did, let's say, 10 to 15 years ago. I mean, we use a number of tools from immediate annuities to our income account or dividend growth to handle income needs. As clients, John, are, I would say, more safety-oriented today, especially after the bursting of the tech bubble and the financial crisis, and they're looking for dependable sources of income. So when we take a look at analyzing a budget, we always want to make sure that, you know, for basic lifestyle needs or basic living expenses, we have as many secured sources of income, because you don't want to worry about how you're going to pay your bills each month. But they're also cognizant of the need that that income needs to increase over time, because they all have experienced some form of inflation, whether they've seen it in travel or medical expenses. But I would say the biggest difference is that they start their retirement with a plan, and that has made a big difference in the outcome. So we've planned for contingencies. We've planned for inflation. And if things change along the way, either due to market, family, or health, we generally have a plan or a backup plan. And John, there is no one investment that is going to solve everybody's needs. So we use a combination of investments that are more custom tailored to the individual bucket needs of that individual, rather than coming up with some magic formula based on age. Because, I mean, let's face it, everybody's a little different. Everybody views risk differently depending on their own experiences or knowledge. They may have different asset sizes, or they may be fortunate or unfortunate enough to have a pension or not have a pension. So everybody's a little bit different. But, you know, the good thing about it is there are a lot more tools available today for planning cash flow than we had, let's say, 15, 25 years ago when I got started in the business. But back then, you didn't need as many tools because the income that you were getting on investments was so high that, I mean, a lot of people long for those days. I still remember the very first client I had putting her in a 10-year treasury note at over 15%.
Well, is there anything that stands out to you right now?
Yeah, I would say the one thing I do hear from my wealthiest clients is, number one, they never thought they would have as much as they did. But then having as much as they did, they would have so little between higher taxes today, lower investment returns. I mean, let's face it. In the 90s, the average interest rate was about 6.7% over that decade. The high for that decade was 9%, reached in May of 1990. And the low for that decade was during the long-term management and Russian debt default crisis in 98, where yields actually slipped down to 4%. But that was 10 to 15 years ago. And I had no trouble getting 5 to 6% returns in ultra-safe investments. In fact, that's where we rode out the tech bubble. We were in sovereign bonds getting 5 and 6% between 2002 and 2004. It's still possible today, John. You can still get 5 to 6%, but you got to think outside the box and you got to look in a lot more places and do a lot more homework. It's out there, but you have to look for it.
Well, as we always do every single week, we have a real-life case study in order to demonstrate the facts we have been discussing here. The studies are real, the real-life case, but we do change the names to protect the privacy of the people involved. So, who do we have coming up this week and their circumstances?
This week, we've got Don and Susan Schiff. Don, age 70, his wife Susan, 68. They had three children, supporting one daughter, who's divorced with two kids, age 42, and supporting a mother, age 94. So when I tell you what their expenses are, you're going to say, wow, that sounds like a lot of money. But in reality, it really wasn't. They were spending about $132,000 a year. Now, they had $27,000 coming in from Social Security for both Don and Susan. Their main source of income was a commercial property that they owned in New Jersey that was passed on to Don and his brother as a result of his father passing away. The unfortunate thing, his portion of income from that property was at 8%. When the property was sold, his portion of the property was $3 million. The unfortunate thing was taxes. And after taxes, roughly about $750,000 went to federal and state taxes. So it left Don and Susan roughly with about $2.3 million with assets. Now, they had two other things. They had two IRAs, one $55,000, one $50,000, and then they had roughly a whole life insurance policy on Don's life that was worth about $500,000. And, you know, I had to be blunt with them. I said, there's no way that I could go out there that I would take the bulk of your assets, put it in something that's going to yield me 8%. It's just not possible. But we can get maybe 5 or 6%, which was going to be closer to what the needs were, because they had $27,000 coming in from Social Security. So what we ended up doing is we ended up putting $1 million in an immediate annuity, and that produced $58,000 a year. That would pay an income of $58,000 to both of them, either Don or Susan alive, or both of them alive. And if it fell short of, let's say something happened to both of them within 10 years, there was a 10-year guarantee on that. We also put in the annuity contract. We wanted a liquidity provision just in case he needed to tap into it to help his daughter or his mother. The other $1.25 million we put into our income account with yields about 5%. So when all was said and done, we got about $58,000 coming in from the annuity, or about roughly $44,000 coming in from investments, which left them just a tad shy of about $3,000. And also they were taking what they called mandatory distributions from their IRAs each year around $8,900, which left them just slightly with about a surplus of $500 a month. We were looking for the stock portion of the portfolio, which was roughly about 40% of the income account for increasing dividends over time. That would be our inflation hedge. But in this case, John, we actually had to take a portion of the principal, $1 million in this case, and put it into an annuity because there was just no way I was going to be able to get the income of 6% and anything that would be safe or guaranteed. I mean, yeah, I could have gone into a junk bond fund at 6%, but a lot of junk bond funds have lost 6 and 7% this year. So we didn't want to do that. So here was a combination. And one of the reasons we recommended the annuity is because Don had a $500,000 whole life policy. which would be paid to the estate, and that would be income tax-free and estate tax-free. So it would basically replace half the annuity upon Don's passing. And we're assuming Don would be the first to go, which would still leave Susan with the $58,000, but she would also have $500,000 additional capital to work with. So in this case, it took an annuity, it took a special income account to basically get the objectives that they achieved. Now, eventually, I assume at some point, Don's mother, age 94, but you know, you don't know today, at the retirement home, he was telling me there were 17 individuals in the retirement home that were over the age of 100. But as long as she is in good health, Don and Susan are supporting his mother, and then he also is supporting a daughter who's divorced with two children. So even though the expenses were on the high side, eventually there will be additional income over time, and then over time maybe some of those expenses will be less than they are now. Eventually, when Don's mother passes away, then they won't have to provide for her long-term care expenses.
And as I always say on this, another successful case study which shows that the principles we're talking about can actually be successfully achieved. Coming up next, Kim Fischera, discussions on year-end tax planning. It's a constant series of hurdles through which you have to jump, but it can be successfully negotiated as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, it is that time of the year. It's hard to believe this year is just about over. You're probably thinking about the holidays, or maybe you're shoveling snow, or, you know, that Christmas turkey or prime rib roast. Probably the last thing you're thinking about right now is taxes. But if you do owe taxes, this is the time to do something about it. There's still some time left. We've got a couple weeks left. Joining me on the program is Kim Fischera. He's a CPA. And Kim, normally around this time of the year, individuals are probably not thinking about taxes, but there are some things that they should be considering. If, for example, one thing that comes to mind is, let's say that you retired this year. You retired in the middle of the year. And so now you're either getting a pension or you're drawing on your IRA or living off investments. Instead of having taxes withheld as you used to do with the paycheck, now that you're retired, you don't have that done anymore. So let's talk about taxes, estimated payments, and what should be done to avoid a penalty.
Well, hi, Jim. Yeah, nice to be with you on your show. That's a really good question, and it does come up, and it's a little more complex than some people realize. And if somebody transitions into that mode and does nothing, they may have an unpleasant surprise at the end of the year, because typically what happens is, like you mentioned, when they start taking their, say, required minimum distribution from their IRA, they don't necessarily have to withhold on that. Some do and some don't. So, you know, the way we deal with that is we have the client either come in or send us a lot of their information, the final pay stub for part of the year when they finally retired, and then information pertinent to their, whether it's an RMD, a required minimum distribution, or just they're just taking money out of an IRA or a pension plan. We need to know the amounts. And then what we will do is figure out what the total tax liability will be for that transition year, which is a little bit more complex than the subsequent years. And we'll take into consideration the amount of withholding they've already taken out from their payroll, or if there's severance pay, sometimes there's bonuses and severance pay, and that gets jerked up a little bit. And then what we'll do is figure out the total liability and see what the shortfall is. And if there's enough time in the year still, we give the client the option of either covering that in the form of estimated payments or making some change to the payouts so that they have federal and state withholding taken out from their retirement distribution, or sometimes a combination of either one. And what I've learned over the years is that some clients don't want any withholding. They want to do everything with estimates because they feel like they're in control. Others don't want to do with the estimates because they don't want to write the checks and they want it to be withheld. So we kind of work with clients and try to tune into what their needs are. And some do a combination of, but that transition year is important, and that's a very good time to meet with your tax professional and try to figure out how you want to deal with it. In subsequent years, it gets a little easier because now you're only retired and you can figure out, you know, what the payout's going to be and how much you need to cover.
But you are doing something different. Is there a penalty, Kim? I know that a lot of times people get windfalls during the year. Let's say they took a large capital gain that might have exercised stock options or things of that nature. And if they didn't have taxes or they didn't pay enough in, is there a penalty?
Yeah, there can be penalties. It's called an underpayment penalty. And the general rule is that in most cases, the IRS wants you to pay in 90% of your taxes as you go throughout the year. I mean, so if you earn money in the first quarter, they want 90% of that in the first quarter and, you know, thereafter. Now, there are exceptions to that rule. The one exception we try to use is called a safe harbor provision. And that allows you, if you're in a situation where your income really spikes up, as long as you have paid in, either through withholding or estimated payments, an amount equal to either 100% of your prior year tax, or if you make over $150,000, it's 110% of your prior year tax, then you can meet that provision, protect yourself from penalties, even though you might owe another 50 grand, you know, come next April. And sometimes clients like to do that because it allows them to basically protect themselves from penalties by paying an adequate amount of withholding, but hold on to the money, for the rest of the money that they're going to owe later, and pay it at the end of tax season. But it is a little tricky because if you pay your taxes in the form of withholding, it's a little easier to avoid penalties because the withholding is treated as though it's paid pro-ratably throughout the year. The IRS can't tell. You know, if you do it all in December, it's still treated as though it was paid pro-ratably throughout the year. If you're doing it through estimates, you have to be sensitive to the dates because estimates are due, you know, April 15th, June 15th, September 15th, and January 15th for federal. So you can't just make one big estimated payment at the end of the year to cover income you earned in the beginning of the year without having some underpayment penalties. I mean, they're mitigated, but you're not going to be absolved of them. So there's a little bit of planning that needs to go on there. And if you have some big windfall, there's another exception to the general rule. It's called an annualization method. And that applies, for example, if you have a steady stream of conservative amount of income coming in during the year, and then you have this huge capital gain in the fourth quarter for $1 million or something, you're not expected to have to go back and pay estimated payments for the first three quarters. You can use this annualization method, which allows you to attribute the income for the penalty calculation in the last quarter. And the accountant needs to do a little bit more work on the return to use that method. And we can mitigate penalties for those windfalls using that method as well.
Kim, let's talk about a situation that in 2012, there was a major tax bill change. And then, of course, we had Obamacare, which also had tax implications as well. A lot of people are thinking about, well, gosh, you know, I don't make big enough bucks. I think, what is it, $454,000 for a married couple and a little over $400,000 for a single. But there are other levels of which certain things happen. And I'm thinking of when you start to lose, for example, part of your itemized deductions, when you start to get your exemptions phased out, and also when you get the additional 3.8% Obamacare tax on investment income. So there are certain things that you can do to keep you below that threshold. And I'm thinking of taking things off from gross income, things like contributions to a 401k plan or a pension plan. Anything else that can help mitigate part of that?
Well, there are phase outs of the itemized deductions, the more severe phase outs, and then there's the exemptions which you can lose. And what happens is if somebody's adjusted gross income exceeds a certain level, and I think, yeah, if you're married, I think it's $309,900 for 2015. So once your adjusted gross income gets over about, say, $310,000, then you start to lose 3% of the excess. To the extent your income goes over that, you lose 3% times that difference of your itemized deductions. So what happens is the itemized deductions gradually get phased out. You can still include them on the tax return, but then there's this big offset that reduces the amount that are going to be deductible. And that also applies to the exemptions. The exemption, I think, for 2015, I think it's 4,000, but, you know, that'll phase out. But that's a smaller number, unless you have lots of kids or something. But yes, you do lose those deductions. It's kind of an insidious backdoor way the government comes in to take your money away, independent of the tax brackets. And then, you know, the 3.8% net investment income tax, that's based on, you know, capital gains and passive income, typically rental property and a number of things. And I think that kicks in once you hit like $250,000 of adjusted gross on a joint return. You know, you start to pay this additional tax. The other issue that comes in, too, is if you're in the top, 39.6% federal bracket, your capital gain rates go up, too. They go from 15 to 20%. So there's a lot of incentive to try to keep adjusted gross income as low as you can by using before the line or above the line deductions, things like IRAs, SEPs, 401k plans if you're employed and you don't have a business. You know, the first line of defense for a person who's employed making big wages is you really want to max out your 401k plans. And personally, I'm not crazy about it. If you're in a really high bracket, unless you're really young, but if you're in a high bracket, I'm not crazy about these Roth 401ks. I think I'd rather get the deduction. That's just my personal opinion. And, you know, it's important to look at what your employer provides you with as far as 401k. And some employers will offer, you know, deferred compensation plans where you can actually defer some of your wages into a plan that does not get taxed until you take it out in future years. So you really want to look at those opportunities. Another thing, too, is an HSA plan. That's another thing you can do and under some circumstances if you have the right kind of insurance. That's an above-the-line deduction as well.
So, Kim, realistically, what are things that you can do at this time of the year? And let's kind of break this up into three kinds of categories of investors. One that's retired, one that is an employee working for a company, and an individual that is self-employed. So let's begin with somebody that's retired. What are some, let's say, good moves that could be made given that we only got a couple of weeks left to the end of the year?
Well, if you're retired, you know, there are limitations on what you can do. I think the most important thing you want to look at is if you have an after-tax portfolio, you know, that's not tax deferred, something that's not in a 401k or an IRA. If you have a big portfolio and you've got lots of capital gains, I don't know about this year. I don't think you have a lot of capital gains this year. We'll see come tax season. But if you have a lot of capital gains, or you've sold a rental property or something and you've got this huge capital gain, that's because I have clients in this position right now. What I always tell them to do is talk to their investment advisor and find out if you can realize any capital losses on your portfolio. And this works really well. I think in this environment, more people might have unrealized losses right now from the stock market, but they might have sold real estate, which has a capital gain. So you really want to try to harvest those losses and take them against other gains, because once the year passes, it's too late. You can't go back and change your mind and try to sell something, or you can't carry back a capital loss or anything. For an investor, that's an important thing to do. Another thing, if you're retired and you want to make a big charitable contribution and you've got this RMD, required minimum distribution. Now, I have to say that, you know, there's a provision that allows you to basically pay the money, have the financial institution make that charitable contribution directly to the charity, so it doesn't show up as income above the line and then get deducted out as an itemized deduction. This really helps with the phase out. However, Congress has not extended this provision yet. They wait till the end of the year every year, and we're not sure if they're going to extend things like that, but it has allowed people to directly contribute to a charitable organization and bypass the recognition of income and charitable deduction, which reduces the adjusted gross income. Now, we think Congress will pass this in early January, but right now it's not on the books. But that's another great provision if you're, you know, 71 and a half and you're taking out your required minimum distributions and you don't really need all money. You can give it away and keep your adjusted gross income lower if that provision comes through. But I would say at this point, you know, those are the main things you can do if you're retired.
What about charitable contributions? Let's say, for example, going back to capital gains, you're thinking of selling something, not sure when you're going to sell it. You don't want to pay the capital gains. What about setting up something like a charitable remainder trust to get a tax deduction and avoid the gains?
That doesn't work for everybody. Typically, somebody who sets up a charitable remainder trust really has enough money to live on, and they're willing to kind of allocate it in advance to some charitable organization, but still get the income stream on it. So what they'll do is they might make a large contribution to a charitable remainder trust, and let's just say they put $100,000 in there. They're not going to get a $100,000 deduction going into the trust. It's going to be calculated based on, I think, their life expectancy. I don't do these calcs myself, but they'll get a discounted deduction for what goes in there. And they might have the right to the income over the rest of their life. So they'll get a K-1 or distribution from this charitable remainder trust and pick up, you know, any of the earnings on that money. But the charity is the remainder man. The charity will get the final principal when they pass away or something. So that's another option for some people.
And let's now go to, let's say, your average person. They work for a living. They are an employee of a corporation. You know, the things that come to mind are, you know, state taxes, paying the property taxes. I know here, you know, we get billed twice a year. So if you want a deduction, you can pay it all at once in, let's say, December or November and get the deduction this year. State taxes, charitable contributions, and I guess for most people, Kim, would be the 401k, although a lot of people don't understand that in the year that they turn 50, they get an additional $5,000. They're able to make a contribution on their 401k program. What about those kind of things?
Yeah, actually, it's now $6,000. I mean, it's now, the base is 18 base, and then you can put another six in there up to, if you're 50 or over. For somebody who's W-2'd, there are limited opportunities, in my opinion, because the first line of defense, as I said earlier, is the 401k plan, because that comes right off the top. That reduces adjusted gross income. Many times the employers match it to some degree. A lot of them have about 3 or 4% safe harbor match. A lot of them are doing that now. So I think you're crazy not to take advantage of that, especially if you're going to get a 3 or 4% match. It's like 100% return on that first amount of 3 or 4% that you put in. But I see clients, especially the younger ones, that don't do this. You know, they come in and they're not taking advantage of 401k plans. And you know, and if it's December, it's pretty tough to jack up that final payroll and put more in there. But that is the first approach that I like to look at. Now, once you get into looking at deductions, you know, charitable contributions are a nice way to go if you're doing it from your heart and you have some organizations. Because sometimes people come in and they say, if I give a dollar to charity, am I going to save a dollar in taxes? And I tell them, no, you know, you're going to save, depending on what your bracket is, if you're in a 40% bracket, you'll save 40 cents on the dollar. So you need to make charitable contributions to causes that you believe in and you're really doing it from your heart, you know, and the government subsidizes it and you reduce your taxes. Now, when you get into prepaying property taxes, that is a good way to go, but we typically run into problems, especially in California, with large real estate taxes are high and state income taxes are high. And what happens to people is they become subject to alternative minimum tax at a certain level. So if they put too much into property taxes, if their California withholding is too high and they're paying a lot in property taxes, those items are not deductible for alternative minimum tax. Also, if they have miscellaneous itemized deductions, are not deductible for alternative minimum tax. So if they're an employee and they have unreimbursed business expenses and they got, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 in unreimbursed business expenses on Schedule A, miscellaneous itemized deductions, those aren't deductible for AMT either. So we have to be really careful in not just telling everybody to go prepay their California real estate taxes, because they may not get any federal benefit on that. They usually will get a California benefit for prepaying real estate taxes, which might save 10%, but it's not always as great as it looks on the surface. So the accountant should always run a calculation to see when they're going to hit the alternative minimum tax before making those decisions.
Now, let's take another situation. Let's take somebody that's self-employed. They've got their own business. You know, the first thing that comes to mind, Kim, is some form of a pension plan, whether it's a SEP IRA, a 401k, or, I mean, there's numerous kinds of pension plans you can set up. And it's my understanding, if, let's say, the fiscal year ends 12/31, if you get the plan in place and set up by the end of the year, you've got till the time you file your taxes, let's assume April 15th, to fund it, and sometimes even later.
That's correct. I mean, the most popular retirement plan for self-employed individuals is usually the SEP, the Extensive Simplified Employee Pension Plan. It's a no-brainer to set up. You fill out a form. I forgot the form number, but you fill out a form. You keep it in your file. It doesn't go to the IRS. You work with your financial institution. They're very familiar with SEPs. And the nice thing about the SEP is it's something you can create after the end of the year. So if you've done nothing all year and you come into our office and you, let's just say you made $100,000 in your small business and you didn't set up a retirement plan, you still have the opportunity, you know, to set up a SEP plan by the due date of the return, including extensions. If you file an extension, you can push it out to October 15th, which is way out there. And if you're self-employed, let's assume you have no employees, to make it simple, and you're self-employed, the SEP contribution is based on a percentage of your net income after all your expenses. So if you netted $100,000 after expenses, you could put in about $20,000 if you don't have any other employees. Now, where it gets a little complicated is if you have employees, you have to start considering contributions for them. I think they have to work there for 3 years and be a certain age and work so many hours, but there's a three-year exclusion on it. So if you have somebody who's worked for you for more than 3 years, you would have to also fund you know, the SEP plan for them based on a percentage of their wages. So that's used a lot. It's an easy way to go. It's great if somebody doesn't have employees because they can max it out pretty easily. If you're a little more proactive and want to do something before the end of the year, we have a number of clients that will set up these single, let's again assume there's no employees. You can set up a single owner 401k plan. Now, let's give an example here. Let's say you make $100,000 net and you put 20 in with a SEP plan, which sounds great. But if you set up a single owner 401k plan before the end of the year and you made $100,000, and let's say you're 50 years old, you could put $24,000 into the plan as the theoretical employee, even though you own the business. And then after the end of the year, you could fund another $20,000, which is, it's 20% times 100, and put more money. So you can really put a much larger amount using a single owner 401k plan in certain circumstances. But again, I'm using an example with no employees. If you start having employees, the single owner 401k doesn't work. You need a traditional 401k, and there's, you know, more administrative aspects to that. You know, so those are probably the two most popular retirement planning tools that we use, and it's just a matter of trying to find the right fit for each client.
And Kim, outside of, let's say, pension plans, that's pretty obvious. Anything else a self-employed individual can do?
Well, the big thing that people like to do is take advantage of the Section 179 deduction. Right now, it's only $25,000, again, because Congress hasn't extended it, but I think last year it went up to a few hundred thousand. I think it went up to $500,000. The bottom line there is that if somebody has their own business, whether it's a self-employed person or a corporation for that matter, one of the things that most of these folks are doing at the end of the year is looking at what they need in the form of equipment, supplies, and spending money. And I always tell people, don't just spend money to save taxes, but go out and if you need a piece of machinery and you're definitely going to need it in the next 6 months, you know, maybe you should get it now. It has to be placed in service before the end of the year. But assuming Congress extends the 179 deduction, you can expense this stuff up to $500,000. And so it's a huge benefit, even if you finance it. The other thing you can do if you're self-employed on a cash method of accounting, you can pay things using a credit card, a business credit card. Even though the credit card's not paid till after the end of the year, you can deduct all of those items on the credit card. The other thing you can do, assuming your cash method, sometimes you can prepay some of your expenses that go into the subsequent year in advance and take those deductions sooner. I mean, the planning that's usually done in years where the brackets are about the same, I mean, right now the tax brackets for 2014, 15, 16 are about the same. So that is an incentive to still try to defer income into the future and accelerate expenses into the present. And that's the general strategy that typically applies in situations like that.
Kim, why is it we talked earlier about the charitable deduction from a mandatory distribution from an IRA to charity? You know, you just talked about the business expense allowance. It seems like every single year there's a certain group of deductions that are out there, depending on who's lobbying Congress for, you know, maintaining a certain deduction. But it happens almost every single year. There's a bunch of deductions and things like that that are left hanging, and we're all left guessing, keeping our fingers crossed, that they're extended.
Yeah, they call them extenders. And, you know, some of the extenders for individuals, for people that don't live in California, like Texas, or that don't have a state income tax, Washington State, you can usually deduct sales tax. Right now, that has not been extended. You know, there's a higher education tuition fees deduction that hasn't been extended. There's a mortgage debt forgiveness exclusion that hasn't been extended. Teacher's classroom deduction that hasn't been extended. The residential energy property credits have not been extended. The big one for the businesses is the Section 179 deduction has not been extended. And bonus depreciation hasn't been extended. So I don't quite understand the logic behind it, but we come up with this problem every year. I guess I would hope that someday Congress would make some of these things permanent and we could plan a little bit more. I have heard a rumor that if they extend them for this year, they might make it a two-year extension versus a single-year extension. So, you know, so we just wait till the last minute and hope it works out. You know, one of the problems from a practical standpoint is our tax planning software does not have these things built into it. And even though there's a good probability that they will come into play later, so that affects some of the planning calculations that we do even.
And finally, Kim, looking at the year going forward, 2016, anything on the horizon in terms of tax changes that we should be aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't see any. But again, I'm looking more at 2015 than I am 16 at this point. The big thing that I have been aware of is the fact that, and this is not so much a tax change, it's just that the IRS budget has been significantly reduced by, I think, over $1.2 billion over the last 5 years. So it's really creating problems from an administrative standpoint. I mean, sure, audits are down a little bit, which is a good thing. But if you do get audited, it's just taking forever to get anything done with the IRS. I mean, the hold times are over an hour if you try to get a hold of them. And individuals usually can't call them. Usually tax practitioners can with long wait times. And if you're dealing with these audits, it's taking much longer to get anything done in most cases. And, you know, if you file an amended return, it's taking over 6 months to get the refunds because to get everything processed. And the other big thing that's accelerated, too, is this whole identity theft issue with IRS. We've had more situations where, you know, somebody has tried to file someone's return, you know, to get a refund. They usually do this in early January. And so the IRS has a whole department dedicated to the identity theft issues. So those two things are happening. They're not really tax issues, but they're more of administrative frustrations that we have to deal with.
So, Kim, as we close, is there anything you hate to see people wait to the end of the year to do tax planning? So let's say if you just retired, you might want to talk to your tax accountant so you can get used to paying quarterly estimates versus what was normally withheld from your paycheck. If you've had gains this year, whether you sold a piece of real estate or maybe you got lucky and bought Apple or Google or something or Netflix and you took some profits, you might want to take a look at some gains. But other than that, it seems like a lot of the things that we used to be able to do from a tax planning point of view, a lot of those have been taken away over the years with various tax reform bills.
Yeah, that's true. And the question you're asking is, you know, who really needs to do tax planning? And, you know, in my mind, anybody that sells a lot of securities, definitely if you sell a piece of real estate, you really need to talk to your tax professional. If you own pass-through entities, S corporations, partnerships, let's say you're a beneficiary on a trust, you may be impacted by unexpected income or maybe deductions from these things you can take advantage of. If you started a new job, terminated, had several jobs during the year, that confuses things. You really need to look at that or get a large bonus. Sometimes the withholding on these large bonuses is not always accurate, so it's a good idea to run a projection. If you start a new business, you definitely want to talk to somebody because we've had people come in here that started a business. We've never seen them before. Now they need a CPA, and they made 50 grand, and they spent all the money. And so they come in, and they paid no estimates. They spent all the money, and they made 50 grand, and they've got to pay, you know, Social Security, Medicare tax now on this. And, you know, so they're talking huge amounts of taxes due, and it's too late if they don't come in and talk early. If you've had large medical expenses and you're thinking about, you know, when to pay them, you know, sometimes you can bunch them into 1 year depending on how much income you're earning because a lot of these are phased out. If you want to make large charitable contributions, sometimes people donate securities or they donate vehicles. Or I had a guy donate a $17,000 boat this year, and I had to remind him to get an appraisal because if you don't get the appraisal, you don't get the deduction. And so if you miss this stuff, we've had people donate large items and not get an appraisal, and they don't talk to anybody, and they come in, and now we have a problem. So, changes in dependents, filing status, you get divorced, you get married, you have more kids, those are all reasons to really talk to a tax professional. And is it too late? No. I mean, there's still a few more weeks left in the year. There might be something you can do. So it's still worth taking a look at it.
Well, listen, Kim, as we close, if we have listeners here in California, they'd like to contact you. How could they do so, please?
Well, they can call our office at 760-431-1220, and we would be happy to talk to them. We don't take any new clients once tax season begins. We go dark during tax season just because we can't take the necessary time to really set them up and get everything pro forma. But we are still talking to people, you know, as we approach the end of the year here. So we'd be happy to chat with them.
Well, listen, Kim, thanks for coming on the program. Happy holidays to you and a happy new year.
My pleasure, Jim, and always good talking with you. Take care.
Well, Jim, two things from the show. Obviously, year-end tax planning is upon us, and that's always a moving target because Congress keeps changing the laws somewhat every year. But also, as far as changing the sources of your income, you know, you look at the fact that we've been at 0% interest, and the Fed just raised it by a skunch. That's all it was, about 0.25%. And we've been at this 0% level, and effectively, you're still there. So you have to look at that and then see what investments have managed to gain the level of return that people need.
Yeah, I mean, this is a topic we've been talking about this. You know, we've been at this level for 7 years. And if you take a look at what the Fed was projecting in terms of where interest rates are going to be next year, they're going to be roughly about 1.25%. And I think they'd be very lucky if they get them that far. So, you know, in terms of where we're going to be, we're going to be talking about income for the balance of this decade. I would not be surprised into the next decade, because there is a massive amount of federal debt out there. And for every 1% increase in interest rates, it costs the government almost $200 billion of additional interest. And so at some point down the road, I would not be surprised if we start seeing the Fed monetizing debt in order to keep interest rates low. And one of the things that, you know, if you take a look at Fed policy, they're basically saying, look, we want to target inflation. The reason they want to target inflation erodes the value of debt and makes it easier to pay off. And that's one of the reasons that you've seen the Fed try to target this, because debt is eroded by inflation and they just haven't been able to get it. But give them long enough, they'll eventually get it. Well, in the meantime, John and I have run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a happy, safe holiday season.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.